Welcome to the GameDev.TV Community Podcast. I'm your host, KB, and I would like to introduce you to industry professionals and people who successfully made their path to the video game industry. I hope that you enjoy the podcast and get useful tips that'll bring you closer to achieving your dreams. Now, let's get right into the podcast.
Welcome, guys. Welcome back to another episode. We have a special guest, my personal friend and boss, Nathan Berglund. He is a image processing, principal engineer, right, Nate? What's your official title?
I think I'm now officially director of software development.
Okay. So, director of software, he's a guru on the computer, knows everything that I ever want to know and will know. So, we're happy to have you, man.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
All right. So, Nate, I have a personal question. I kind of want to know a little bit about where you got started. So, like, I know you went to grad school. I know you got your PhD. Well, I know how that went. What happened before that? So, before Georgia Tech?
So, before Georgia Tech, I went to a little bitty school in the middle of Indiana called Rose-Hulman Institute of Technology. Funny thing is,
bachelor's?
Yeah, Ken, who is my boss, Ken knows somebody else who went there. And he's like, oh, Rose-Hulman, I know somebody who went there. I'm like, really? Because most people, I got to explain it because they've never heard of it.
I've never heard of it, to be honest.
Neither.
Now, okay, were you always into technology?
Probably as far back as I can remember. I just, you know, I liked understanding how things work. You know, I've always been kind of a nerd. I remember some story that my mom tells about when I was like, I don't know, two or three or something, and I was trying to figure out how many wooden blocks I could stand on end. And she's like, yeah, you spent like all day or something trying to see if you could stand the ridiculous number of those on end. And you're like, I think I can get one more.
Were they like Jenga blocks?
Got the balance, not, you know, because the first few, those are always easy. But if you get the center of gravity wrong, even slightly on those first few, it messes you up further down. So the trick is you got to keep adjusting those ones further down as you add more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. I'm just picturing how hard you'd be focusing, trying to get every block perfect. I can see it. One.
Like 4-year-old Nate.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you played with a lot of Legos.
Oh, yeah. I had the Lego Technic sets growing up. I built, probably the biggest thing I built was this Lego car set. Remember one summer, I saved up all summer long, saved my summer allowance the entire summer so that I could buy this Lego car that had actual like moving parts and gears and stuff. Pretty cool.
That's awesome.
That's cool. Now they make tons of those. They got all sorts. Yeah. They got like Lego spiders and Lego everything.
I've used Legos professionally. So the first company I worked at out of college, were developing an ear canal scanner, and some of the first prototypes built included Legos because they were really great for building prototypes out of. Except we did things that children wouldn't do to Legos, like drilled holes in them and filled them with Bondo and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, yeah,
I wasn't doing that.
Like actually building
Legos.
Professional use of Legos. That's ridiculous.
I wonder how that came to be. Like, who thought of that, to use Legos? And they're like, yeah, it'd be a good idea.
They play with them as a kid, and they're like, oh, well,
company's
might as well.
Tomorrow. Like, yeah, Legos are great for prototyping stuff, actually.
Good point, honestly.
Oh, because you could probably just, like,
just snap them together. Yeah, there's no, like, screws, no tape.
Yeah,
and they're cheap.
Yeah.
And they're light.
That's really cool. Can you remember when we were in the museum in Greece, and that, like, it was built out of Legos?
They made the whole, like, all of Athens in Legos.
Yeah, it was awesome.
They had a whole wall of what?
No, they had like the city made out of Legos.
Yeah.
You know, like Legoland, but they did it for Greece, for Athens.
For Athens, yeah.
How big was it?
It was pretty big, dude. It was pretty big. It's a museum. Yeah. You walk in, you're like, yo, what? It's like,
and like every single thing was made out of Legos?
It was more of the major point of Athens. So like where all the monuments are. But yeah, they had everything built with Legos. Little Lego people. They had the Parthenon up there. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really nice. Just allude to the fact that they used Legos as a model. So it's cool.
Like, are you going to pay me? Do
it. No. Legos, Nate, huh? That's where you got started, huh?
Yeah,
that's where it all began. No, well, where did it begin? Where did you realize, like, computers is kind of, like, the thing you wanted to do? I guess you kind of grew up in that revolution, right?
Yeah, because... I mean, so I always knew that, like, from a very early age, like, math just fascinated me. Just the fact that you could describe something with an equation and, like, being able to explicitly write down how it worked was pretty cool. I think it really took off when I won this TI-85 graphics calculator in a math competition, and it was really the first time I had a calculator that can do more than just your basic stuff, but it had a programming language in it. I'm like, this is really awesome. I wonder what I can make it do.
You can make it do a lot of things, yeah.
So you're interested more of the computer aspect of it rather than like mechanical and like fabricating like the physical performance
hardware
of it. Yeah, so you're more into software than hardware.
Yeah, I'd say definitely more software, although I have done, you know, I've built an Arduino and built little electrical circuits and stuff like that, because that's always fun.
Always. What's that thing you built, you were telling me about, that you took to a festival?
Oh, yeah, the 30-sided, it's a 30-sided shadow of a six-dimensional cube called a... octahedron.
What's it called?
They call it a rhombic, like as in rhombus. So it's built out of rhombuses. Triacontahedron.
Jesus.
Which means basically 30 sides. The three, and then conta, I think, is Latin or Greek or something for 10. Basically, okay. So it's a 30-sided object.
And where in the hell did you get that idea?
Well, it was inspired by a different but similar shape, which is the rhombic dodecahedron, which is a 12-sided figure. And I saw that originally on a blog from Burning Man. Somebody had built a giant version of this and taken it to Burning Man. I'm like, that's awesome. I want to build something similar, but maybe not the exact same shape, but something like it.
I'm curious, how was that process like? Were you like, this is how I'm going to do it? You had like a drawing board? Because like, I don't know where you're going to begin with that.
Yeah, did you make like a 3D model or something?
This is a quick sketch.
I was able to find a model on the internet, so you can find all these things. But as far as like building it, a lot of it was just kind of trial and error. So I'm like, okay, how am I going to make the pieces fit together? It's like, well, with 30 sides, if I just try to take 30 pieces of like plywood or something and try to glue them all together, I was worried at that point that it wouldn't be very strong. I'm like, I could see this thing just falling apart as soon as I build it. So, so I'm like, I need to build some sort of core that it can sort of glue to. So I did a little bit more thinking and I realized I could fit a dodecahedron inside of it, which is a 12-sided object with pentagon-shaped faces. And the faces would be able to meet the vertices of the ultimate shape, in the corners. So I'm like, well, a dodecahedron is easier to build. I've built those before.
Just on a random set
out of wood and screw them into the wooden dodecahedron, and so that was my starting point. So I built that. I'm like, okay, this is pretty stable. But then it was tricky because like I didn't really think in advance how I was going to attach the rhombus shaped pieces to the dodecahedron. So I had this dodecahedron. I'm like, okay, so now I have to attach the rhombus shaped pieces, and I haven't really thought about how I'm going to do this. And it turned out to be trickier than I had imagined.
Yeah,
build some braces and stuff to make sure that they didn't move and that they attached exactly where they needed to. So, like I said, a lot of trial and error, a lot of, you know, starting something and then like, nah, it's not going to work this way, taking it apart and trying again.
What'd you make it out of? Just wood and glue?
Yeah, it's so the structure itself was made out of wood, and then I wired it up with L wire, electroluminescent wire. That was part of it. I wanted it to light up at night. So it lights up. The kind of cool thing about it is this shape. So like I was saying, it's the shadow of the six-dimensional cube. So I rigged up the L wire to light up in sequence. So in the sequence of dimensions, this wire to light up is just a single edge of this thing. So an edge is a one-dimensional. You can think of an edge as being a one-dimensional version of a cube.
Right.
And then a rhombus lights up. And a rhombus, you could think of that as sort of a view of a square. So a shadow of a square could be shaped like a rhombus if you tilted it. So it's sort of a distorted square. It lights up next. And then the next wire that lights up completes the square, and you get a whole cube that's lit up. So, and you can see three faces of the cube from one side, and then the other three would, of course, be hidden behind it. So you have these three rhombuses that kind of form a shadow of a cube that light up, and then the more L wire lights up, and you have a shadow of a four-dimensional cube. And then
you made it go through the dimensions.
So it goes through each dimension, and sort of you can see the cube growing into the more and more complex shape.
Did you program that? Was there any like Arduino involved?
Yes, I had to write an Arduino program to light up the wires in sequence. I played around. So there's this cool program called Audacity. I don't know if you've messed around with it. It's like an audio.
Isn't that what we use? Yeah, that's what KB uses to edit these.
Well, no, I don't use it to edit, but I use it to... That's how we recorded the first one.
Yeah, oh, okay. I use it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. You can do lots of effects with it. And I, so what I used, I wanted to... I noticed when I first built this thing, right, the sixth wire was a lot more wire than the first one because you got all these dimensions that are lighting up at once. So what I noticed would happen is the circuit would turn on and the first strip of wire would turn on and it would be really super bright, like almost, I was worried about burning it out because it was too bright. But as more and more wire lit up, the load on the circuit would get higher and higher, and so they'd get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer until the whole thing, you know, you could noticeably see the wires getting dimmer. I'm like, I don't really want it to look like that. What can I do to fix that?
Mm-hmm.
So I read a little bit more about how L-wire works, and it's basically like a capacitor. And you hook this capacitor up to an AC circuit, and it puts a load on it. So I'm like, well, what if I figured out what the capacitance of this was and just put some actual capacitors in there? Because I had this controller that had 8 ports, and I was only using 6 of them. So I'm like, maybe I could connect a capacitor to 2 of the ports and sort of make them like fake L-wire, if you will. But the thing was, I didn't know what the capacitance of the L-wire was per unit of length. And of course, there was no spec on these things. These were just cheap pieces of L-wire that I bought off of the internet. And people buy these for parties and stuff. Nobody usually cares what the capacitance is. So of course, it wasn't listed. All right, how am I going to figure out the capacitance of these L-wires? And I noticed they make a distinct sort of high-pitched hum when they light up, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I know where this is going.
Pitch of the hum depends on the motor that's driving it, because the more load that's on it, the lower or the higher the pitch goes. I forget, but the pitch changes depending on how loaded your circuit is, right? So what I did was I took a microphone and I recorded the different L wires lighting up in sequence, and then opened that audio file in Audacity. And with Audacity, I was able to figure out what the main frequency was.
That's insane.
You're a genius.
You're a genius.
You're literally a genius.
This is insane.
10 kilohertz now. So I know that if I light up this much L wire, it resonates at 10 kilohertz. And if I light up twice as much L wire, it's at, you know, 20 kilohertz. So uh-huh. I was able to work out the math and figure out what the... basically what size capacitors I needed so that in my Arduino code, I came pretty close to balancing the load. So the brightness changes a little bit because if you have 2 different loads and you have 6 pieces of L wire, you know, you won't necessarily be able to balance it perfectly, but I got pretty darn close simulating 2 different pieces of L wire that were 2 different theoretical lengths.
As far as brain power, on a scale of 1 to 10, how difficult was it to figure that out?
I mean, it was a bit tricky. I'd say, I mean, it wasn't probably not the hardest thing. I'd rank it as a 7. It was significant.
7. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I feel like I would have ran into that, like the capacitance problem, and just been like, oh man, I don't know. And I guess I wouldn't know what I would have done, but I definitely would not have recorded the sound and tried to do it that way. But
I think,
kudos.
You can hear the pitch changing. I'm like, I can hear the pitch changing. That's got to tell me something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fair.
Wow. Yeah, I think I used those wires for one of my art pieces I used to like light up. One of my pieces that I did buy it from Amazon. I'm guessing it's the right thing, because when I do turn it on, it does have, like, that sound that you're talking about.
Like a humming?
Yeah, like that humming sound, yeah.
Is it that blue one? The blue?
Yeah.
Yeah, Victor. So Victor's an artist. He does a bunch of woodwork, which is kind of funny that you're saying that you built that whole wood contraption with the luminescence, because a lot of what Victor does is literally cutting very, like, abstract shapes, and, I mean, he could tell you more, but... then he'll line it with like a bunch of luminescent like wire and stuff. He makes this stuff look real futuristic. It's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. Yeah, there's like this weird like juxtaposition between like the futuristic lighting and then like the classic look of wood. I use them like against each other, which looks pretty cool.
It's all right. No, I'm just kidding.
wood just looks beautiful. I mean,
yeah.
Who could love wood?
Mm-hmm. Especially when you sand it down and you make it all like real look real smooth and soft, like nice clean edges.
Maybe you get a wood that's kind of a nice dark hardwood.
That's cool, man.
Now, what was your experience like at Rose Institute of Technology?
It was pretty cool. It was a small school. The classes were, I don't think I ever saw a class that was more than 30 students. And that was really one of their big selling points was we're a university that's focused on teaching. A lot of universities out there are focused on research, but all of our professors are dedicated to teaching. They're not out publishing papers and research. And so it really showed.
Mm-hmm. Was it a private school?
No, it was not private. But it was small.
Yeah. It reminds me of, the reason I say it is because it reminds me of Stetson. That's where I started. I was there for 2 years, and the same thing. It was like the biggest class I ever had, I think, was like 40 kids. But that was for like a composition one, like basic level class. And then you get into the degree, and like computer science one and all that was like maybe 15 kids. And it's just, and then it gets down to 10 kids by the time you're in their third year because they can't take it or whatever. But yeah, I liked it though. I like being able to like literally be 10 feet from the teacher, call him over, say, look, I really don't understand this. Could you just explain it to me again? And him be able to walk you through it instead of having, 150 kids and a TA teaching who's like has to go find the teacher and set up office hours or whatever.
Yeah, the professors like knew all of their students, I think that was a big plus.
Yeah.
Like, hey, Nate, how's it going?
So you went from, I'm sorry, what was the name of it? Rosalind?
Rose Hallman.
Rose Hallman. So you went from Rose Hallman to straight to Georgia Tech, or did you take like a gap and do something else in between?
No, went straight to grad school at Georgia Tech. It's funny, it was actually, Georgia Tech was the first choice of both me and my roommate at the time at Rose Hallman. And we both got accepted and were like, hey, we should just be roommates at Georgia Tech. So we were for a couple of years till he got married and then moved into his own place.
That's cool. What did he do?
He was also in the math department. He wanted to study operations research and he wanted to go on to teaching. And I think he's in Washington State now. He's I think he actually got a tenured professorship not that long ago. So I congratulated him on that.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty awesome.
What advice would you give someone if they're trying to get a major in mathematics and computer science?
It can definitely be done. You kind of want to find, so you want to look at the requirements of both and see where they overlap. You can't really do a master's that way, but I did a bachelor's that was a double major, math, computer science. And they're very similar, especially if you're taking courses on theory of computer science or theory of computation, that could be considered a math course or a computer science course, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then how much time did you spend studying? Like, was that like a lot, like 12 hours a day? Was it like to get those good grades?
It was pretty significant. I wouldn't say that I studied all the time, but it would really depend on kind of the difficulty of the material. So I know there were some periods where maybe I'd spend a whole month, 12 hours a day, just hitting the books, trying to understand it. But it wasn't like it was constantly like that. Sometimes the material wouldn't be so hard and it would be like more of a normal workload. I'd actually have weekends where I could relax.
Mm-hmm.
And so your PhD wasn't in computer science though, right? It was in mathematics?
It was math, yeah, and I say almost PhD, so it's everything but the dissertation.
And what happened there?
It was just timing, and I think I chose a project that was probably a much longer project than should have been chosen for a PhD. You know, it could have been maybe a five-year project. We didn't really, the professor that I was with was very new to the field, so he suggested a problem that it seemed like it was maybe doable, but the part of the difficulty was we were actually trying to figure out what the question we were trying to answer even was. So it was involving a problem that color cameras, most color cameras have to deal with unless they have prisms to break up light, which is a sensor doesn't detect different frequencies of light. All it detects is a voltage based on how much energy is coming in. So if you look at a pixel inside of a camera, it will return an intensity value, but that's really all you get. So you might wonder, well, how do you get color pictures from a digital camera then? Well, there's this trick that they use where they put an array of filters in front of the pixels. So maybe the pixel in the upper left corner is covered by a red filter, and it filters out other wavelengths of light besides wavelengths that are in the red range. And then the pixel next to it will have a green filter in front of it. And same thing, it filters out frequencies of light all except for ones that are in the green range. And then you'll have a blue filter, and you get this alternating pattern of red, green, and blue filters over the individual pixels. The pixels still measure intensity, but now you know that the upper left pixel is telling you how much red light it measured, and the pixel right next to it is telling you how much green light it measured. So you can sort of guesstimate what the green value of the pixel should have been by looking around at your neighboring pixels. And the process of guesstimating this is called demosaicing, and it's actually a pretty hard problem. There's a lot of algorithms out there for doing it, and they all have their pitfalls and they all have their advantages. But so we were trying to find a mathematical framework to basically derive a demosaicing scheme that was mathematically based. But I think part of the problem is there really is no generic mathematical model of an image, of what it means for something to be an image. And that's a hard problem that computer scientists and image processing researchers, it's been open for decades. And still, nobody really has a complete mathematical model, because if you allow anything, then an image of just random noise is allowed too. You don't want to allow that. So you kind of have to impose some sort of constraints on what is allowed to count as a valid image. And it was around 2008, around the time of the big .com bubble. We were trying to find a sponsor to continue the research for a sixth year, because sometimes you can do a sixth year in grad school, but you have to find a sponsor, and we just didn't find one in time.
Wow. I have a side question. So I'm not too familiar with coding and computer science, but is there a certain degree of coding involved in computer science? Is that like a large part of it, or is that a small part of computer science?
You're saying coding in computer science?
Yeah. So like, there's like mathematics that goes into computer science, and there's like...
Right. Well, go ahead, yeah. Nate.
If you're a computer science major, you're going to write a ton of code. You're going to be coding a lot. So yes, computer science is very heavy on the coding.
Because the coding is mainly responsible for like functions and kind of like the brains of the...
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, like the coding, you can use mathematics and really any kind of numerical in code, like with code. So like with code, you can demonstrate that and use it for purposes that bounce off more code. And you kind of have to see how it all layers together. But yeah, the computer science is the science of computers and how, you know, would you say that it's the science of how computers work or how to make computers? I guess it could be any direction depending on where you go in computer science, but definitely coding involved. Lots of it. Yeah.
I would almost call it the science of programming.
Yeah. Okay. Did you make any big sacrifices to get where you are today?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there's always, you can always think of, you know, what could I have done instead of this? And I guess, you know, there's always, life is only so long, so there's always a ton of different things that maybe I could have done, but I can't think of anything that I would consider a major sacrifice. I've always kind of just gone in the direction that felt natural and seemed like, you know, this is something I'd like to do. It never felt like I was doing it at the expense of something else that I really wanted to do.
Okay. Now, what is the transition like from graduating to becoming a teaching assistant? What was that like?
It was one of the ways that you can kind of fund your graduate school. It was actually a paid position. I made about the same amount as you might make it, you know, working a summer job.
Mm-hmm.
But it really was just kind of a matter of there was grading papers, which was always sort of the mundane part of it. It's kind of like doing paperwork. The fun part of being a teaching assistant was actually interacting with the students.
I bet that helped you learn a lot faster, right?
Yeah. And you know, you don't calculus 3. I think I really deeply understood calculus 3 when I tried to teach it to other students.
Yeah, because you're like, I need to know what I'm talking about if I'm going to teach someone. Yeah,
sounds solid. Mm-hmm. I think I understand calculus 3, but the real test of do I understand is can I teach it to somebody?
Yeah, if you could explain it. Ooh.
I feel like that'd be pretty fun, teaching people and like trying to help them, and you know, them running into the same problems that you know you ran into, and then you can give them a solution right away instead of watching them, you know, their brain start to melt as they can't figure it out or something.
Yeah, not really give them the answer, but guide them, right?
Guide them. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
A student that you know teaches you something, that they have a new way of thinking about something, and you're like, wow, I never thought of it that way.
Absolutely.
So, would you ever teach again, like, for like a small mass of people? Would you ever?
Yeah, I could see myself doing that again. You know, I wanted to, part of why I didn't go straight into teaching was I kind of wanted to go out and, you know, actually do stuff. I mean, I know teachers do stuff, but, you know, I wanted to make things, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Right. So what has been your most rewarding, like, project you've done or you work with?
Let's see. Probably the ear canal scanner was the, because that was a really tough technical problem that we solved, being able to get a scanner into somebody's ear canal. We don't know what it's going to encounter when it gets inside the ear canal. It could be full of hair, wax, who knows what. Yes. We got to try to still take a 3D scan of the surface of that ear canal with a tiny probe tip that has a lens that's never been designed before. The company that I work for had this lens custom designed, and at the time it was the smallest wide-angle lens in the world. And then it's being imaged through this glass tube, originally that was from an old thermometer tube. And then we had to get accurate three-dimensional data out of all of that.
Wow.
That's so it was quite a challenge. It took a good 2 years to go from, hey, we can actually see something, we're seeing laser light, but our scan just looks like garbage. It's just a potato. You'd scan an ear and you'd get a potato, basically. Something that actually started to look like an ear canal, too. At the end of it, we were actually getting the accuracy that we wanted, which was 200 microns. If it was less than 200 microns, the research showed that the person would not feel any pain when they put it in their ear, and it would be anything less than 200 microns, and it would be a good fit.
Okay. Wow, that's actually pretty cool.
How did you go about getting rid of the noise? Like you're saying, it created a potato with the scan. How did you clear that up?
So there were a multitude of things. So like with the wax, we had recommendations for cleaning the ear canal. We didn't want to go overboard because I knew how to make an ear canal totally pristine, and I'd done it to my own ear canal, but obviously we can't ask someone to sit and have their ear canal thoroughly cleaned for like 20 minutes before they get fitted for custom earbuds or hearing aids or whatever. That's kind of ridiculous. So we had some of that, but then some of it was we had a real-time tracking system had this headset that they would put that kind of went around their ears and had a pattern of dots on it. And so part of the challenge was being able to track that in real time and get accurate position data to compensate for any head movement that might be happening while the scan was in place. So originally that tracking system was not really dialed in, and we honed in the accuracy, got it down to about 50 microns of precision. So that helped them look less like a potato. And then another thing was the calibration. So we needed a mathematical model of the light rays that came into this contraption, I would call it, because they would get distorted by thermometer tube that was put in front of it. And originally, since we were using thermometer tubes, they'd usually have a flattened portion of it, because that's where you would put the little tick marks that showed the temperature. Mm-hmm. And of course, for what we were doing, that flattened portion was completely useless. And we eventually, when we got more funding, we eventually switched to glass tubes that did not have that flat part. But in the beginning, we had to deal with that. So the mathematical model that I came up with to describe what the light rays were doing had to account for that.
Wow.
Getting that down pat helped it look less and less like a potato. And then there were some image processing techniques that we did to detect if, for example, the laser hit a piece of hair, it could detect that it was something was going on that was not normal, and it could basically erase the hair. So we had a whole subphase of it called laser hair removal. It's if you're seeing a reflection of a laser off of a piece of hair, how do you remove it from the image? And we call that laser hair removal. But laser hair removal helped make it look more like an ear canal.
Could be more of an accurate name.
Yeah, honestly. A little less technical, I guess. What do you like to do other than take on really hard problems?
I like to play with fire.
What's that mean? What's that mean? You got like the torch, right, that you spin, like you do fire spinning?
Yeah, it's called poi.
It's called what?
A couple of balls of fire on the end of two long chains that you spin around.
Yeah, I've seen that. And when did you pick that up?
So that I started back in around 2011, I would say. So that's been spinning it for a while now.
You do any shows?
nothing official. I've spun for friends and stuff like that.
You live near the beach, right? I bet you go out on the beach and do it, right?
Yeah, I've got photographs of me spinning fire in the ocean, which is always a lot of fun. You can see the fire reflecting off of the waves.
Oh, that's too cool. All right. You grow stuff now too, right? You just picked up growing like vegetables and all sorts of stuff in the backyard.
Yeah, I think a lot of people started gardening when the COVID crisis hit, but it's mostly my wife, and I just sort of plant the seeds where she tells me.
I can't do that.
You can't leave habanero?
No, dude. No way. I can't do spicy stuff at all.
Dang.
When I was in Thailand, they gave me this. What'd you say?
I put red pepper on everything. Red pepper flakes, eggs, pancakes. No, not
I'm better about it now, for sure. Like, I have tested myself, and I've risen up the ranks, but no. Can't do that, bro.
Sprinkle some cayenne pepper on your pancakes.
Oh, my God.
How long did it take to learn how to do fire spinning?
Lineup. You've heard of Potluck? What was that? The show where they eat the spicy hot wings.
Yeah, I love that show.
They interview people.
I went through their entire lineup, and that was pretty crazy. The bomb was awful.
You went through the whole lineup?
Yeah.
What, by yourself? Just because?
No, together with other people.
Probably Eli.
That sounds like a fun time.
That's funny. Okay. I don't think I could do it. I really don't. I'd probably get like a full through and just get
basically. Basically, you'd probably be red.
You have no idea. Okay, my face gets red, but like when I am like when I cannot breathe because it's so hot.
If you breathe, that burns.
It's awful. It takes like an hour to go away. Why? It's not enjoyable to me.
No, but it's for the challenge.
It's a good pain.
It's for the challenge. Is that what you did, Nate? Did you actually enjoy it?
See if you can get to it. I had to pause for a little bit on the bomb. I wasn't sure if I'd be able to continue. I'm like, oh god, this just doesn't stop. That's the thing about the bomb. It just, the heat just keeps coming at you, and it seems like it gets more intense over time, at least at the beginning. So you eat the spicy.
Your body's still processing.
You're like, it's gonna chill out soon, right? And it just keeps coming up.
Tastes awful.
Your body's then, like, oh, I can handle this, and then.
And after you've eaten it, it's not over. It just keeps getting hotter for about the next 5 minutes. It's like, when is this going to end?
But what about your lips? I bet your lips are, like, on fire.
Yes.
Everything.
Did you eat it with chicken wings, too?
Yep, we got chicken wings.
Hey, nice. The official.
Sounds so good right now.
I know, I literally am picturing them. Like, that sounds amazing.
Now I want wings.
Without the hot sauce.
Yeah, without the hot, like, I want it to be enjoyable.
I'll take some garlic parm. I'll take some lemon pepper.
I'm going to say lemon pepper, yes. Best.
Hands down.
Zaxby's has got that tongue torch. It sounds spicy, but it's not, and that's how I look cool.
That's how I like it.
Oh. Give me the tongue torch. I'm hardcore.
It's like medium. It's like, I can take this.
What was the interview process like when you left college and went into Shape Start measurement systems?
Yeah, that was the first job. So I don't know if my experience is typical, but ShapeStart was a real small company, and actually all the companies I've worked for so far have been small companies. So the interview was actually not that scary. It was really just like, hey, here's what we do. You know, what kind of stuff are you into? What do you love to do? And then, of course, there were some screener questions because they want to make sure that you actually know your shit. But it was, other than that, it was fairly informal, and it was kind of like, wow, you guys are doing some pretty awesome stuff here. This is the kind of stuff I usually like to do. And they were like, we can tell you like to do it. So why don't you come and work for us?
Awesome.
Where do you see yourself in the next 5 to 10 years? Like working for the same company, or is there something you have your eye on?
I mean, I'd like to work from the same company. I'd like to grow the company. Myself and the other director, you know, we have ideas for how we're going to do that. But yeah, I'd like to see Easy Systems kind of become start to be more recognized, and people actually know who we are.
Now, what advice would you give college students trying to land their first job?
So I would say you're going to have to interview a lot of places to really find that perfect fit. And don't necessarily just say yes to the very first offer you get. You know, really know what it is you're looking for. And when you find that good fit, you know, then say yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, people, the being prepared is something everybody knows you got to do for an interview. But a lot of times people aren't thinking the reverse. An interview isn't just they're interviewing me. I'm also interviewing them.
I'm trying to figure out,
is this a company that I really want to work for?
True. I think that's good advice for not only college students, but all people looking for employment.
Yeah.
You know, take your skills where they're going to be like, enhance, and where you can also fit in and feel good about what you're doing. Very important.
Now, for the listeners who don't know, what exactly is Easy Automation Systems?
So we are a company that focuses on machine vision and automation. And so a lot of the work we do involves the design of custom machine vision inspection algorithms for whatever it is that you're trying to do. So if you have an assembly line and you're trying to let's say you have product and you want to know if some of it is defective, and maybe you have a robot arm further down the assembly line that will take the defective ones and throw them away. Well, you need a machine vision inspection system to be able to tell whether it's defective or not, and that's where we come in. That's our expertise. And we can not only design the algorithm to detect if it's defective, but we can make recommendations as to you know, what sort of cameras you want. We can help you integrate it into the line. We have a mechanical engineer that can help design components and integrate it into your existing system.
Wow, that's
really cool.
Yeah, that's necessary.
I'm glad you're here. I hope you need.
And how did you get involved with them? Were you director right away, or?
No, I started as a senior image processing engineer. Mm-hmm. That was about 3 years back. And I just sort of grew with the company, and learned more and more, and it just sort of made sense when they were the founder was wanting to kind of structure the company. He's eventually hoping to retire, so he wanted to have a bit more of a structure there, because originally it was very flat. It was basically him and then everybody else. So he was the boss and everybody else worked for him. So he wanted to create a couple of directors to help organize the company a little bit better.
Yeah, and help scale the company too.
Yeah, he named me as the software director. Then we have another guy. He's the director of operations and engineering.
It's always good to have people who have that same vision you can like actually depend on, so smart move on his part.
Yeah, and grow the vision, you know, and sustain it at the same time. You want to keep it going.
Yeah. Now, that's one thing I know about Nate and Ahmed. Ahmed's the other director, but mm-hmm. I can definitely see, like, they have a vision where they want to grow, mm-hmm. they want to get bigger, they want to expand, and it's exciting. It really is.
So how did you become director? Did you say, like, hey, I see a vision for this company, I want to help make it happen? Or he was like, hey, I need someone to make my vision grow?
Well, I mean, originally it was him who approached me.
Okay.
Nice.
But yeah, after talking about it, it made sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw that there was kind of one of our strengths, which is also in a way is a bit of a weakness, was that we tend to be very independent. Each individual in the company can really work on their own, and with their projects, they can actually talk to the customer and they can figure out what needs to be done and they can go ahead and do it, which is really awesome. You know, that when you have people that are very self-directed like that. But it becomes a disadvantage when everybody has their own different way of doing things. And, you know, sometimes you get situations where two different people have created the same thing at different times and they don't know about it. And so, we want to avoid that.
That's not good at all, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, for anybody who wants to be a director, what does it take to be a director? Like, how can they get in your shoes?
Well, that's a good question. So for me, it sort of fell into my lap. but it's really your vision. You know, you could start by, you know, showing, because you want the person higher up to kind of make that judgment call that you would be good for directing. And I was already doing some of that work even before I was officially director. You know, I was helping direct people on projects, and people were asking, you know, who would be good for this? You know, who can we put on that task? We've got a particular project coming up that, you know, I think, say, Yamini would be really good at. So I was already doing some of that work. So I would say, you know, volunteer to do the kinds of things that a director would do, and then maybe bring it up with your boss.
I like that one. It's like, do the job before you get the job, because then it's just no brainer. You're like, oh, you're already doing it, so here's the title. Keep doing you.
Yeah.
It's basically
doing it without the pressure of actually being there, but still getting that experience.
Now, since it's not that big, I'm not sure if maybe you have a very, like, you know, system for this, but like, how important is leadership and integrity for easy automation systems?
Well, I think that's very important. I mean, we've got to stand behind everything that we do. And sometimes there are even situations where you have to stand behind something that is not technically your fault. Mm. But, you know, as a company, if you put something out there, and let's say you have a collaborative effort that involves multiple different components, sometimes you've got to take responsibility, even if it's not technically your fault, and say, we're going to help you debug this issue.
Okay.
You know, and customers really see that. They really appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a big one. Being able to, like, go out there and say, like, we made a mistake, but we'll fix it. And then, so, like, leadership is just, do you have, like, a program where you teach, like, the higher-ups or anybody, like, how to lead each other or how to take responsibility?
So we've taken some management courses from the American Management Association. So that was actually, Ahmed and myself just decided that that was something that we should do.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of self-directed.
Well, that's a big one, because leadership is key. Yeah,
as far as official certifications, we don't have any, but it's more of kind of a mindset the moment.
Yeah. Anybody can have certification, but not everyone can be a leader and actually lead people and be empathetic and, yeah.
And so, as a director, you have a team?
Yep.
And what qualities do you look for in the people you want on your team?
So, I mean, I want people to be self-motivated, and we're really good at that right now. You know, I want people to be responsible. I want people to be good at documenting what they do, because if you just do something and you apply a bug fix, let's say there's a fire you're putting out, right, and you get it fixed, that's great and all. But if you didn't document what you did, it's really not as useful, because that, you know, something similar could come up again, and you've really got to document it if you want to avoid repeating that same scenario. So people who can get the job done are great, but people who document how they did it are even better.
Awesome.
Interesting.
Yeah. I guess one last thing I would say is, what would you tell anybody just starting out in computer science?
Don't give up.
That's a good one. Don't give up.
I would pick some sort of programming project that you think you'd be interested in doing. You want a little web app that I don't know, organizes photos from your phone or whatever it is. Whatever it is, pick some sort of application or some sort of project that interests you personally, and you know, try to find a way to do it with programming.
No, I like that one.
That's awesome.
If you're ever near Jacksonville Beach, let me know. I could spin some fire for you.
Oh, yes.
That'd be awesome, yes.
Teach us how to build a triple decahedron or whatever it was.
Yeah, but that took some time. That was like 2 years.
Yeah,
but
honestly, maybe you need to link up with Victor and teach him how to build one. He'll put it in one of his art shows.
Yeah, oh, that'd be so cool. Victor Ali. So cool.
Yeah, I started looking into this thing called tensegrity or something, and like they use like, what do you call it, like physics and, like, I don't know.
What do you call that?
They basically make something like it's floating by having like these contradicting forces at the
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So it looks like it's floating, but it's like all the forces are balanced.
Yeah,
that's awesome. You should definitely build one of those.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing something like that. Yeah.
All right. Well, yes. if you guys don't have anything else, Nate, it's been a pleasure, man. I really appreciate your time, honestly.
Man, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a pleasure also.
And we'll hand the mic to you if you want to do any last shout-outs or inspirational quotes or anything before we end it off. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Yep.
don't put him on the spot like that. Hey, thanks a lot, Nate.
Cheap dreams.
Cheap dreams and all that stuff.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening. You can find all GameDev.TV courses at courses.GameDev.TV/courses or in the show notes with a 10% discount. Get started with your game development journey today.